welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, November 27th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. And from the front page of today's Gazette, End of an Era for Alliant Lansing Coal Power Plant by Brittany Miller of the Gazette. Alliant Energy's Lansing Generating Station, a coal-fired power plant, has operated for nearly 75 years along the Mississippi River in northeast Iowa. After this year, it will no longer produce electricity. Its closure will take hundreds of megawatts of energy generation out of Iowa and its neighbors on the power grid. It marks the latest casualty in the series of coal-fired power plant retirements sweeping the country in the past decade. The gaps present opportunities for cleaner and often cheaper energy sources, renewable generation like wind and solar power. In October 2020, Alliant announced its Iowa Clean Energy Blueprint, the company's roadmap for retiring its coal fleet, increasing its use of renewable resources, and reducing its emissions in the state. Alliant made the decision to retire its Lansing generating station while creating that plan, said spokesperson Morgan Hawk. Retiring the facility would help to control long-term costs for customers, he said, referencing how renewable resources have grown to be more cost-effective than traditional fuels like coal. And obviously, retiring the facility contributes to a healthy environment. The facility's closure will leave Iowa with 7 utility-owned coal-fired power plants, with at least one, Alliant's Prairie Creek Generating Station in Linn County, scheduled to stop using coal by 2025. Meanwhile, Alliant's blueprint has mapped hundreds of new megawatts of renewable energy generation in Iowa for the coming years. MidAmerican Energy has 2, although some environmental groups, tech companies, manufacturers, and a state attorney said they are skeptical of the plans without seeing more data. In its lifetime, the Lansing Generating Station has helped provide electricity to customers across the central United States, thanks to its role within the region's power grid. The facility's retirement prompts a look at its history and the environmental impacts that come with operating and closing coal-fired power plants. The Lansing Generating Station started providing coal-fired energy in 1948 with one 15-megawatt generating unit. A similarly sized unit was added a year later, followed by a 38-megawatt unit in 1957. 20 years later, a fourth and final unit joined the site, one capable of producing 275 megawatts of energy, blowing away the capacities of its on-site predecessors. Each of the generating units has retired one by one since the turn of the century. As the power grid has matured through the decades, so have the sources energizing it. Transmission lines now span miles, spreading generation infrastructure further apart, and fuels are evolving. For Alliant, that progress means swapping coal for cleaner and cheaper renewable energy. Its Iowa Clean Energy Blueprint aims for 400 megawatts of solar power and 75 megawatts of battery storage as coal-fired plants are phased out. The renewable additions will boost the company's existing 1,300 megawatts of wind power in the state. We're moving away from having these large centralized power plants to having more smaller decentralized power plants, said Alliant Strategic Project Manager Justin Foss. You've got a stronger, more resilient power system, a better system overall. Transitioning to renewable resources will avoid the investments required to keep Alliant's coal fleet operational, providing lower-cost energy to customers. However, it's unclear if those decreased expenses will translate to lower rates for customers. Alliant touted in its blueprint that the investments will help Iowa customers avoid more than $300 million in costs over the next 35 years, but energy bills are made up of several components, including usage costs, transmission service charges, and energy costs, according to current fuel prices, Hawk said. Solar and clean energy resources are only part of the total cost of delivering energy, he said. While clean energy resources will cost less in the long run, other costs will continue to fluctuate. At the end of the day, we still have to have the same amount of electrons going on the grid as our customers are pulling off it, Foss said. What's the most cost-effective way to do that? That's what we're constantly trying to evaluate. Also from the front page, Iowa sees increase in respiratory illness in children. Tips for spotting RSV and lessening your child's risks by Elijah Decius of the Gazette. After largely avoiding spikes of cases for the last 2 years, pediatric clinics and hospital floors are seeing a sharp rise in RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, among children. The latest numbers from Iowa's Respiratory Virus Surveillance Report showed 938 cases of the virus, a sharp increase from 155 cases in the first week in October. In Cedar Rapids alone, the uptick in positivity rates and hospitalizations of children has given doctors new cause for concern with a virus that's been around for several decades, with tendencies to spike in the winter. We've had very high numbers, as have pretty much all pediatric units in the state, said Dr. William Ching, pediatric hospitalist at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. We're seeing higher severity, particularly among toddlers. I think it's going to be a long season. Usually, spikes in RSV start to show up around December and January. But just as concerning to Ching is the fact that he's seeing more children over age 2 getting bad cases of the virus, which disproportionately affects young children. This year, he's been at about twice as many patients over 2 compared with previous years. Pediatricians are seeing the increase on the clinical side, too. As parents contend with COVID-19 and the flu, RSV is just another concern piled on top as the holiday season arrives. We're having more kiddos come in with viral-type symptoms, said Dr. Amy Schumacher, pediatrician at Mercy Pediatric Clinic in Cedar Rapids. It's definitely making our clinics busier. As a respiratory virus, RSV symptoms overlap with many general cold and flu symptoms: fever, congestion, runny nose, decreased appetite, coughing, sneezing, and wheezing. But unlike those other symptoms, there are a few critical symptoms indicating respiratory distress that parents should watch for in babies and young children: flaring of the nostrils, audible grunting during breathing, and head bobbing. Other warning signs, such as a child's belly going up and down while breathing, indicate the child is struggling to breathe as the body uses accessory muscles in the diaphragm. Dehydration is a risk with RSV, and children who aren't feeling well generally won't eat as much or can't keep food down. For babies, a rule of thumb indicating dehydration is less than 3 wet diapers in a 24-hour period, or less than 1 about every 8 hours. In addition to symptoms of respiratory distress listed above, fevers that are not getting better or lasting more than 5 days are an important reason for a child to see a primary care provider. In order to be admitted, one has to have significant respiratory distress. We evaluate kids in terms of how fast they're breathing and whether they're showing retractions, oxygen saturation using belly muscles, said Ching. For children with milder symptoms, supportive measures at home will be helpful. Nasal saline suction can clear noses. Acetaminophen or ibuprofen can ease pain, and a cool mist humidifier can reduce discomfort. Most typical symptoms peak within 3 to 5 days, though a cough can last up to 6 weeks in children and longer as adults. As family gathers for the holidays, Schumacher recommends a simple rule that can go a long way: have relatives refrain from kissing babies. It's such an easy way to spread a virus that can be really dangerous for a baby and mild in adults, she said. It's one easy step to avoid having their child admitted to the hospital for RSV. Additionally, keep babies away from adults with mild cold symptoms, like a runny nose, as much as possible. Another easy step is ensuring every member of the family gets their flu shot as soon as possible with a doctor or pharmacy. Other preventative measures are straight from the COVID-19 playbook. Keep your distance from sick people, wash your hands frequently, and consider wearing a mask. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth, and cover your cough. Parents with children in daycare should prepare for a higher risk. If they're in daycare, they will almost certainly get it just because of how prevalent it is and the community and how hard it is to keep kids apart, Ching said. It's hard to say for sure why RSV is coming back with a vengeance this year, Ching said. For the last 2 winters, pandemic mitigation measures worked against RSV in addition to combating COVID-19. People were masking more and avoiding large gatherings during the holidays before a large portion of the population had access to the COVID-19 vaccine. Soon an RSV vaccine could be available. The University of Iowa is currently participating in a Pfizer vaccine trial with 140 participants. From the Iowa Today, the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state, under the heading In the News, National Democrats to Decide Caucus's Future. An Iowan on the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee, which will decide the calendar for the party's presidential nominating contest next month, said the party is giving Iowa's caucuses a fair hearing. Iowa Democrats and Republicans have been the first to lodge their preferences for president in their caucuses since 1972, but the National Democratic Party plans to rework the calendar and may knock the state off that prized spot. The party is seeking to prioritize states that hold primaries, have diverse populations, and are competitive in presidential elections, all measures that Iowa does not score highly on. Scott Brennan, who sits on the committee, said on Iowa Press this past week that Iowa Democrats have a shot at remaining first. Private school voucher bill likely to reappear. A push to shift millions in taxpayer dollars from public schools to private school tuition assistance is likely to be back in the next legislative session. Earlier this year, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds floated a $55 million proposal that would fund 10,000 private school scholarships using public school dollars, but the measure failed to pass. Advocates are hoping the measure will be expanded this year, as several GOP legislators who oppose the measure were voted out in primaries. Researchers equip plows with visibility tech. Iowa State researchers are developing systems for the Iowa Department of Transportation that would allow snowplow drivers to better navigate bad weather conditions. The system involves attaching sensors to snowplows to allow the drivers to see better on the road. ISU researchers have been developing the technology for the last year, and earlier this month, they installed the first version of the equipment on a DOT snowplow for testing. Using LIDAR technology, the sensors will allow drivers to see where the plow is in the lane and show potential obstacles that may be hard to see or hidden behind snowdrifts. Davenport seeks federal grant for quiet zones. As the Quad Cities brace for a potential rail merger that will increase train traffic in the area, Davenport plans to apply for a U.S. Department of Transportation grant that would pay for safety improvements and quiet zones at Davenport Railroad intersections. The city is asking for $2.7 million for the $3.4 million project. The merger between Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern is expected to triple train traffic on Davenport's tracks. Davenport was one of several Mississippi River cities to accept millions in settlements from Canadian Pacific last summer to offset potential costs incurred by the merger. Under the heading, they said, Iowa's turkey pardoning event is something I look forward to every year, but with a statewide order currently in place to protect flocks from the threat of avian influenza, we're honoring the tradition a little differently this year. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, in a virtual address, pardoning two Iowa turkeys. And spending vital taxpayer money on private school vouchers, when our public schools need resources to address the needs of the nearly 500,000 students attending them, is harmful to Iowans in every community across the state. Iowa State Education Association President Mike Baranek on private school tuition assistance proposal. Under the heading Odds and Ends, opioid settlement nets Iowa millions. Iowa will receive $42.6 million from opioid manufacturers Teva Pharmaceuticals and Allergan in two multi-state settlements. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller joined the case, which accused the drug makers of deceptively marketing opioids and not doing enough to prevent diversion. Turkeys pardon virtually. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds kept up the annual tradition of pardoning two Iowa turkeys ahead of Thanksgiving, but the ceremony was done virtually this year because of the threat of bird flu. The ceremony usually is conducted at the governor's mansion in Des Moines, but state orders have prohibited live bird exhibitions as bird flu has been infecting flocks. And under the heading Water Cooler, COVID cases rise. Iowa's number of new confirmed COVID-19 cases over the week ending Wednesday was the highest in 2 months, with 2,302 new cases reported, compared to 1,980 the previous week. And cybersecurity breach. Iowa PBS's annual fall pledge drive was canceled after an apparent cybersecurity breach. The breach did not affect the station's ability to broadcast. No other information about the issue was immediately available. Turning to the Insight page, Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, Reader responses help make writing a joy. I hope Gazette readers had a wonderful Thanksgiving with family and friends and were able to reflect on the things for which they were thankful. I remain thankful for many things, my family, my friends, having a couple bucks in the bank, and the fact that if my Cyclones could only win a few games this season, at least one was against the Hawkeyes. We've still got that. I'm also thankful that real avenues still exist in which authentic discourse can take place and that it still matters to so many of you, including the tens of thousands of subscribers to the Gazette. We live in an era where communication has become so cheap, where even the most inane thoughts of any person can be shared and viewed in seconds and debated and discarded in minutes. Yet many of you took the time not only to read my column, but also to sit down and craft a thoughtful response to it. Most of your responses were delightful. Some of them were not. All of them, however, remind me of how important it is that forums for discussion in good faith are preserved and that they remain local to our communities. The biggest collection of responses my column received this year came after I wrote about President Joe Biden's executive order to forgive up to $20,000 in student loans in late July. Many of those responses outlined readers' feelings of resentment over what they felt was the rewarding and continued enabling of unwise decision-making. I rarely, and I mean rarely, comment about something in the newspaper, but I feel deeply about your column, wrote a reader from Iowa City, who went on to detail the sacrifices she and her spouse made to afford their own education. They impressed those same priorities upon their two sons, who heeded the advice of their parents and worked all through college to pay their own tuition. The reader's story was compelling, but it wasn't unique. None of the readers who shared their frustration with student loan forgiveness expressed any wish to see young Americans punished for the naivety of assuming up to six figures of debt for an education that will never yield the income to pay it off. They also don't wish to be liable for those decisions or for young college students to remain so easily susceptible to making them. The resentment is felt nationally, but the stories that illustrate why are local. Personal anecdotes go a long way in helping a person demonstrate their viewpoint, which is why I frequently opt to share my own, and why I'm so interested when my readers share theirs. In July, I shared that I've been prescribed opioid pain medication for years for chronic arthritis pain, doing so to paint a picture of the barriers that chronic pain patients face to obtaining their medications. In response, a reader from Marion wrote about dealing with her own persistent pain after two back surgeries in the 1990s. People do not think much about chronic pain until it strikes them, the reader wrote. Then, that's all they think about. Much of the feedback I receive from readers is that they appreciate the variety of perspective that my column adds to the fold. One might interpret that as, I agree with it, so I like it. And in some cases that's true, but one shouldn't underestimate the feedback I get from readers with contrasting political views. I had a very brief back and forth about education funding and student needs with another reader from Iowa City after I wrote school choice failed because legislators failed at the end of May. We didn't really agree on anything, but our exchange ended with him writing, I will continue to be a reader of your column as I find you to be honest and forthright. That works for me. I would encourage all readers not to treat the insight section as either their political echo chamber or their political punching bag. Since my transition from contractor to Gazette staff, I've been copied, along with up to 16 other Gazette writers and editors, on 446 emails sent to date from one person at a rate of up to 8 per day. They all contain some politically motivated jibe directed in poor taste at a specific writer or a link to some partisan amplifier website about a subject that we would cover if we weren't such a fake news rag. It's important for all 17 of us to be copied on these emails, you see, so we all have an opportunity to be reminded up to 8 times per day how stupid the Democrats are and how the Gazette is a horrible dumpster fire of a garbage publication. After I had the gall to share that I vote Republican, another reader sent me a list of 12 different policy positions, all worded in a rather leading way, ranging from gun control to school funding to taxation. Her email instructed me to respond to each with a simple yes or no with no further comment or rationalization, so I could apparently qualify whether my political views make me worthy of that reader's consideration. I'm happy to engage with those whose views differ from mine, but as I explained to the reader, I don't do cross-examinations. That's not how this works. That being said, most readers do find value in reading opinions, or even just experiences, that differ from theirs, which is part of what makes writing this column such a privilege. While I myself am on the other side of the divide, wrote a reader from Cedar Rapids, an echo chamber helps nothing and no one. I have a feeling you and I have similar conversations with some folks in our own tribes from time to time. She's not wrong. Some readers just flat out amaze me with their ability to find common ground, even among differing perspectives and experiences. After I wrote about mask mandates at hospitals interfering with medical care for some patients who can't tolerate masks, myself included, a reader in Mount Vernon shared how, quite unlike me, she prefers continuing to wear a mask due to her issues dealing with anxiety. Yet despite two radically different situations, the reader described the anecdote I shared of debilitating headaches as visceral, and my thesis, that refusing care to patients who cannot tolerate a mask may cause real harm to those patients, as relatable. How is that exactly? If I were told I couldn't be seen at the place I have gone for years, I'm afraid to imagine how that would trigger my anxiety, she wrote. Telling a patient to seek care elsewhere is inhumane and wrong. As one of the columnists, I'm supposed to be the one sharing intelligent insights with readers, or at least something that passes as such. But readers have the ability to put their own brilliance into words in their own unique way. I hope you will continue to do so with your emails, your phone calls, your comments on social media, and most importantly, your letters to the editor. Putting things into words may be what I'm employed to do, but the honor of writing this column is one thing I will never find the words to describe. Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column. Todd writes, wrong is wrong, no matter how many vote. My journalism career is going on its third decade. Too long, according to some sources, but one of the privileges it's provided me is a chance to have a front row seat as LGBTQ Iowans fought and gained civil rights in Iowa. Before my career began, I was a House page who watched state representatives debate, in 1989, a bill that would add sexual orientation to the Civil Rights Code. It offered some of the most dramatic moments I've seen in the legislature. It passed the House only to stall in the Senate. But even debating such a measure 33 years ago put Iowa ahead of the curve. I was covering the Senate in 2004 when four Republicans joined with Democrats to defeat a constitutional amendment that would have banned same-sex marriage. It was a brave, surprising stand against their majority caucus. One GOP senator, Maggie Tinsman, lost her seat after taking that vote. Iowa had a law banning same-sex marriage, but the amendment never passed. I was covering the legislature in 2007 when a Democratic majority added sexual orientation and gender identity to the Iowa Civil Rights Code, fulfilling the aspirations of 1989. I stood outside the Iowa Judicial Building on a sunny morning in 2009 as I watched young Iowans bolt from the building, smiling and waving papers over their heads. It was the Iowa Supreme Court's Varnum ruling, unanimously striking down Iowa's statutory same-sex marriage ban. I was in a hotel ballroom a short time later as the plaintiffs were told they had won a landmark victory. Caught up in the historic moment, I wrote that marriage equality in Iowa was being built not on sand, but in stone. The rights of LGBTQ Iowans were gaining as fast as those kids running out of the judicial building, and it was all in keeping with Iowa's tradition of trailblazing on civil rights. Now it feels more like the political landscape is shifting like sand. After recent legislative sessions and this month's election, Iowa's rightward political march is undermining those historic gains, leaving LGBTQ Iowans feeling threatened. Last weekend, just before Transgender Day of Remembrance on Sunday, a gunman attacked an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado Springs, killing five and injuring dozens. A clear motive has not been established at this writing, but it's understandable that the LGBTQ community feels unsafe and under siege across the nation and in Iowa. Many of us in the LGBT community have been saying for months that the amped-up rhetoric against us was going to get someone hurt or killed. It is disgusting to see politicians use marginalized people as a way to punch down rather than lift us up, said C.J. Peterson, chairman of the Iowa Democratic Stonewall Caucus. The people who attack our families in the name of family values must recognize that our families have values too. My husband and I are proud members of our church. We pay taxes. We proudly fly the flag on holidays. We love this state and our country, Peterson said. We've just completed an election campaign where Republicans heaped derision on transgender Iowans, kids in particular. Governor Kim Reynolds and U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson rode to victory after repeatedly assailing the Lynn Mar School District, my family's district, for offering support policies to transgender students. They portrayed these students as a threat. They strongly implied being transgender isn't real. Iowans still know boys from girls, Reynolds said in her final campaign ad. Reynolds signed legislation barring transgender girls from participating in high school and college sports without evidence that their participation is an issue in Iowa. 19 other bills were filed in the legislature in 2022 seeking to restrict LGBTQ rights, including one that would erase the victory in 2007 by removing gender identity from the Civil Rights Code. The former president of the Iowa Senate accused the media and educators sticking up for transgender rights of having a sinister agenda to harm kids. We've seen repeated efforts across the state calling for the removal of books the governor calls pornographic from school and public libraries. Lawmakers talked of sending educators to jail for making the books accessible. A group of parents in Van Meter, according to the Des Moines Register, objects to the book Melissa, featuring a young student who identifies as a girl. The book was put on an optional reading list. They even objected to a math story problem featuring a same-sex couple. Critics targeting LGBTQ books pushed two Vinton Public Library directors and an interim director to resign, closing the library temporarily this summer. In Maquoketa, citizens demanded that a teacher remove a pride flag and Black Lives Matter banner from her classroom. School boards in several Des Moines suburbs faced demands to ban books, including works by LGBTQ authors. None of the books would be considered obscene under Iowa law. The list goes on and on. In overturning Roe v. Wade, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas suggested in a concurring opinion that marriage equality and other rights could be overturned. The U.S. Senate recently voted to move ahead with a statute that would protect marriage rights under federal law. To her credit, Republican Senator Joni Ernst voted to advance the bill. But GOP Senator Chuck Grassley voted no, citing a threat to religious liberty. To be clear, there is no effort in Congress or the courts to overturn Loving v. Virginia, which recognizes interracial marriages, or Obergefell v. Hodges, which recognizes same-sex marriages. I don't believe the Supreme Court would reverse these cases even if they were challenged, and I don't believe it is prudent for politicians to imply otherwise in order to fabricate unnecessary discontent in our nation, Grassley said in a statement. The actual discontent in our nation and state is being fabricated by Republicans trying to scare a segment of Iowans for political gain. They're capitalizing on this discomfort of Iowans who dislike the world as it is and want to live in a world that used to be or never was. They're scapegoating their fellow Iowans for problems that don't exist. They're using their vast power to target marginalized kids who can't fight back. They have no concerns for the consequences, including violence, that their dark, dishonest, and ugly rhetoric will spawn. My husband and I are just like your family. We want to be left alone and free to live and raise our own family in peace. The governor and her political party, of which I was once a member, must tone down their rhetoric, Peterson said. Just for writing this column, I know I'll be called a groomer and worse, but that's nothing compared to what it's like for LGBTQ Iowans fearing for their basic rights and security. It's not going to get better at an even redder statehouse. Those of us who reject fear and embrace the fight for rights need to speak up as loudly as the outraged forces seeking to pull us backward. School board elections are coming in 2023, and the stakes will be high. The politicians and others peddling nightmares are not even remotely credible. Iowa has had marriage equality for 13 years. Where is the predicted polygamy? Where is the destruction of traditional marriage? Where are the harmed children and jailed pastors? The spiteful lies flow so easily from these loving Christians. I don't care who won the election. Wrong is wrong, no matter how many people vote for it. And turning to the community letters, and the editorial cartoon today is from Clay Bennett, a syndicated cartoonist from Counterpoint Media. It shows the back of a convertible automobile. The top is down, and we can see a lock on the steering wheel that says Respect for Marriage Act. And written on the back of the car, which has tin cans tied to it as if it's a wedding car, it says Marriage Equality, Love is Love. And then there's doodles of little hearts and two male signs together and two female signs together. The first letter is from Jim White of Robbins, who to believe on making America great. So, according to the Donald during his latest visit to Iowa, it's under siege and we're in decline, etc., etc., blah, blah, blah. But wait, on the same stage was a governor who spent millions for slick mom and apple pie state fair parades and patriotism ads telling us how absolutely wonderful Iowa is, except for those LGBTQ kids, and that she's responsible for it all, with the help of billions of federal dollars from that communist non-president Joe Biden. I guess fear, lies, ignorance, and hate-mongering produce wonderful, accepting, prosperous, and open communities. We finally have the long-sought-after formula for making America great again. Jim White of Robbins. Next letter is from David Eklund of Cedar Rapids. Once middle, Gazette now leans left. I am a daily reader of the Gazette. Your record on picking the winners in this election had to be pretty dismal. I think you chose almost every Democrat in your process. How can that be? The Gazette used to tread in the middle, but now it is so left on almost every issue. You need to take a look at your objectiveness in the next election. Stop worrying about losing the Gen Z readers. They don't know what a newspaper is. David Eklund of Cedar Rapids. Next, David Sherwood of Cedar Rapids writes, Respect for marriage is bipartisan issue. It's great to see bipartisanship still exists in Congress. 12 Republican senators, including Iowa's Joni Ernst, voted along with Democrats to allow debate to proceed on the Respect for Marriage Act. It appears both sides became concerned after statements by Justice Clarence Thomas that same-sex marriage was going to be targeted following the SCOTUS reversal of Roe v. Wade. On the other hand, our senior senator, in defense of his no vote, apparently somehow missed Justice Thomas' remarks, indicating it was already the law of the land by virtue of the 2015 SCOTUS decision. David Sherwood of Cedar Rapids. Next, Stephen Carfrey of Cedar Rapids writes, Loss of child care funding a tragedy. Uncle Sam offered Iowa a grant of $30 million, which would be put toward child care services. Iowa had to commit $3 million in matching funds and another $1 million for administrative expenses. Governor Kim Reynolds' administration either turned it down or missed the deadline to apply. Do the math. That is a net of $26 million for child care in Iowa that we won't receive. State officials recommended using other funds to replace some of the $30 million federal money. That makes no sense to me because, in my mind, the governor's administration still shortchanged the citizens of Iowa $26 million. Maybe there are more issues or strings attached to the grant, and if there is, the governor needs to explain. If Iowa missed the deadline to apply, are the people responsible still employed? Will they be receiving year-end bonuses, and will they be attending the governor's Christmas party at Terrace Hill? When I first read this, I thought it was fake news, but now it turns out to be a Shakespearean tragedy. Stephen Carfrey of Cedar Rapids. Next, Scott Burnett of Cedar Rapids writes, Iowa has gone right-wing crazy. Congratulations, America, for showing there still are places with rational voters who care about democracy and people's rights. Unfortunately, Iowa isn't one of those places anymore, as we've decided to go full MAGA right-wing crazy with all branches of our government. First, we have a senator that's been in Washington longer than I've been alive, and I am retired, all the while saying he's in favor of term limits. And then there's Governor Kim Reynolds and her band of merry white men controlling the state house to make women second-class citizens and choke our public schools of funds with their mean-spirited attack of our teachers, school boards, and even students. Considering their hatred of the public school system and the declining enrollment, I hardly think it's the time to be spending $300 million in Cedar Rapids to tear down old buildings only to build new while they siphon off money for school vouchers. So my vote will be no on the bond proposal. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Welcome to Crazy Town, Iowa. Scott Burnett of Cedar Rapids. And next, Selma Dannenfelser Brigham of Cedar Rapids writes, "Loss of child care cash shows lack of concern." Thanks to the Gazette for informing us about our Republican leadership declining the child care grant offered from the federal government. For a party purporting to be supportive of family values, the value of human life, and fiscal responsibility, this is utter hypocrisy. It's been stated that this loss of that money is a deliberate decision to avoid having to commit $3 million in matching state funds toward child care. I think I remember that Iowa was looking at a budget surplus. How does this jibe with making it easier for parents to be employed and children to have reliable care while parents are at work? Let's see some concern for children who have been born, not only the unborn. Selma Dannenfelser Brigham of Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Gazette for Sunday, November 27th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Falgido, and we turn to today's obituaries. Minnie Bullock, age 87, of Vinton, passed away Thursday, November 24th, and Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton is handling arrangements. Arlene Ann Berry, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on November 17th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Private family interment and services will be held at a later date. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is caring for Arlene and her arrangements. Arlene loved going to auctions and spending time with family. She could talk your ear off about back in the day, and she loved collecting anything chickens. Malik Xavier Cook Bay Jr. of Marion passed away on Wednesday, November 16th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private family services have taken place. Malik was born June 28, 2022, in Cedar Rapids. He was a very happy baby with an extremely beautiful smile. Malik was a strong, big boy that will be missed by his loving family. Charles Herbert Osterkamp, 72, passed away Thursday, November 17th. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 2nd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Charles was employed at the Midland Forge and retired after 39 years of service. He enjoyed fishing, was passionate about vehicles, painting, and drawing. And Sherry Lynn Osterkamp, age 70, passed away on Thursday, November 17th. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 2nd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Sherry was a homemaker. She enjoyed the time spent with her family and friends. She was a devoted and wonderful wife, mother, and grandmother, and sister. Raymond J. Heyer, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on November 22nd at Terrace Glen Village, surrounded by his family. In agreement with Ray's wishes, he was cremated and placed in a companion Together Forever urn to be kept by his wife until her passing. The urn will be entombed in the Cedar Memorial Mausoleum at a later date with military honors. Ray served in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. Ray worked at Rockwell Goss until his retirement. He was an active in the Masons and the Order of Eastern Star for many years. He enjoyed camping, fishing, gardening, playing card games, family vacations. Michael Allen Novotny, age 61, of Marion, passed away on Wednesday, November 23rd at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 29th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where the family will greet friends an hour prior to service. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Michael enjoyed his time working for Options, cheering on the Iowa Hawkeyes, and visiting Camp Courageous every year. He had the greatest love for animals. Anything with four legs was his best friend, especially all the family dogs. He loved Christmas lights so much he wanted to see them year-round. Leona LaVon Morris, born Leona LaVon Corum of Central City, age 93, she's currently in Solon, formerly of Central City, went to be with Jesus on Thursday, November 24th at Solon Care Center in Solon. Family will greet friends and family from 4 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, November 29th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 30th at the United Church of Christ Church, located at 38 5th Street North in Central City. Burial will follow at Mount Clark Cemetery in Central City. Leona worked from the time she was a young teenager. After farming, she worked at Collins Radio and was very proud of working on the Apollo project. After retiring from Rockwell Collins after 23 years, she became a cook at several nursing homes in Cedar Rapids and Marion before really retiring at the age of 87. She loved collecting cookbooks, of which she had hundreds. It is somewhat fitting that she passed away on Thanksgiving, as she was always full of gratitude and she loved to cook. Bert Roseberry, 98, of Center Point, passed away on November 21st of congestive heart failure after 2 days at the Aldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. There will be no services. Bert was a fourth-generation Center Point area farmer. He was appointed as a rural representative on many Linn County boards and commissions throughout his life. Reverend Marvin L. Anen, 85, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, November 17th, at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Memorial service, 3 p.m. Saturday, January 7th, at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Marion. Visitation, 1 to 3 p.m. prior to services at the church. The Reverend Anen served the Lutheran Church as an ordained minister for 25 years. Marvin was a devoted and well-loved pastor to many throughout his 17-year tenure at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. For the next 15 years, Marvin served as director of pastoral services at the Good Samaritan Society in Davenport. He loved restoring and driving two antique Model N Ford tractors, continuing his love for internal combustion engines. He went on many tractor rides with his friends in the two-cylinder club. Kent Goldsmith, age 80, of North Liberty, passed away on Tuesday, November 22nd. A visitation celebrating Kent's life will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Friday, December 2nd, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Private interment will be held at a later date in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Kent worked at U.S. West Telephone Company from 1960 to 1999, when he retired as manager of design services. He was a member of St. Mark's Lutheran Church, Marion, Cedar Rapids Corvette Club, Ducks Unlimited, and the Telephone Pioneers. Birdina Fiorino, known as Birdie of Anamosa, for 100 years until our Lord called her home to heaven on November 19th, Birdina shared her unlimited reservoir of love with everyone blessed to know her. She and her husband Hank owned and operated Hank's Hardware and Appliance, a pillar of the business community on Main Street in Anamosa, for almost 40 years. Birdina's love for her Anamosa community was also something to behold. She knew everyone in town, and over the years spent thousands of hours just visiting with friends. She was the first lady of Anamosa during Hank's two stints as mayor in the 1960s and 1970s. She was a member of the hospital auxiliary, driving patients to doctor appointments and chemotherapy treatments, helping St. Patrick students with reading, or serving at funeral dinners. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Anamosa. Visitation will be from 9:30 to 11 a.m. There will be a lunch served in the church basement immediately following the Mass and an interment at Oakwood Cemetery in Monticello. Father Sean Smith will officiate and Deacon Bean will assist with the Mass. Getch Funeral Home has taken Birdina and her family into their care. Carolyn A. Knight, age 58, of Robbins, passed away peacefully, surrounded by her family on Saturday, November 19th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A celebration of life will be held at a later time. Carolyn loved to laugh, spend time with her family and dogs, win at the slot machines, and always enjoyed road trips and garage sales to get out of the house. Norma Jean Andresen, born Norma Joan Coover of Keystone, age 86, of Spirit Lake, formerly of Keystone, was called to heaven on Friday, November 18th, from Lake's Regional Healthcare in Spirit Lake. Her children were at her bedside. Memorial services will be held 2:30 p.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel in Keystone. The Reverend Brian Jack of Milford will officiate. Visitation will be held at the funeral home from 1:30 p.m. until the start of the 2:30 p.m. memorial service. Interment for Donald and Norma's companion urn will be held at the Keystone Cemetery following the service. Celebration of life will be hosted at the Keystone Turner Hall beginning at 4:30 p.m. Norma and her husband were members of First English Lutheran Church, and Norma was a member of the Ladies' Guild. She began as a hair care volunteer, but soon became employed as a housekeeper at St. Luke's Nursing Home. Within her 15 years there, she thoroughly enjoyed the residents and strove to make their days brighter. She told a story that her supervisor, Al Flork, drove her to work one morning on his snowmobile in a raging Northwest Iowa blizzard. True love and dedication to those she cared for. Robert R. Jared, age 85, of Marion, passed away Monday, November 21st at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital. A visitation will be held from 2 to 3 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories on Saturday, December 3rd. The funeral service will begin at 3 p.m. with burial following the service. After he completed high school, Robert enlisted in the U.S. Navy. He worked as a mail carrier and gave over 30 years of service to the U.S. Postal Service. Evelyn Maxine Duro, age 97, of Robbins, formerly of Center Point, passed away Thursday, November 17th at Emory Place in Robbins. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 30th at Anchor Bible Church in Center Point. A private committal will follow the service. In addition to being a housewife and mother, Evelyn worked at the Standard Appliance Company and Linn County Administrative Offices, retiring in 1991. Evelyn was a member of Center Point United Methodist Church, now Anchor Bible Church, Center Point Historical Society, and American Legion Auxiliary. Pamela S. Kramer, age 69, died on Wednesday, November 23rd, at home in Lisbon. A memorial visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 27th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories stateroom. Pamela was an avid Hawkeyes fan. She enjoyed going to games and screaming from her chair. She worked at Rockwell Collins from 1972 to 2013. After retirement, she and Tom enjoyed traveling, camping, fishing, gardening, and picking up sticks in their yard. Kenneth John Happel, age 90, of Marion, died Thursday, November 24th, in Winslow House Care Center. A visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Tuesday, November 29th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Ken was a supervisor for Rockwell Collins. He was an avid St. Louis Cardinals fan and played slow-pitch softball many years. Mary Maxine Herb, age 79, of Fairfax, died Wednesday, November 23rd, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, November 29th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will take place at 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 30th, at the funeral home. Entombment will follow the service at the Linwood Cemetery Mausoleum in Cedar Rapids. A luncheon will be held at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood following entombment. Mary worked at Collins for over 38 years. Mary and Jim traveled many places together with their kids, friends, and each other. She was set on seeing the world and living life to the fullest. Jacqueline Joy Terpkosh, known as Jackie, age 68, of Cedar Rapids, went home to be with the Lord on Saturday, November 19th, at St. Luke's Hospital. Private family services will be held in the spring at Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is caring for Jackie and her family. Jackie worked at Rockwell Collins, the Linn County Sheriff's Office as a dispatcher, and retired from Radiology Consultants of Iowa RCI in Cedar Rapids. She enjoyed family gatherings, playing games, going to the casino, live theater, going to movies, the Colonels, reading, crocheting, and had a love for collecting anything that had to do with kangaroos and dolphins. She was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church. Evan Leroy Watkinson, age 91, of West Branch, died peacefully at home on November 23rd. A celebration of life will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, November 28th, at the Kirkwood Room, 515 Kirkwood Avenue in Iowa City. Cindy Lee Baldwin, age 57, of Iowa City, passed away on November 16th. Cindy was spontaneous and resourceful. Every time you would turn around, she would be bringing you something interesting and cool. Free mulch, free wood, free swimming pool, free furniture. Everything she did was try to make each child happy and surprise them with something unique and special, such as airplane lessons, camping trips, drives to beaches, and parks. Cindy Baldwin was an amazing woman, a wife, teacher, grandmother, fighter, artist, and lover. According to Cindy's wishes, cremation has been accorded, and a celebration of life service will be held at a later date. Patricia Ann Hinton, known as Pat, age 82, of Marion, died Wednesday, November 23rd, in St. Luke's Hospital from a sudden illness. Celebration of Life service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, December 2nd, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, where a visitation will begin at 9 a.m. until service time. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, is in charge of arrangements. Patricia was very crafty for years and loved doing craft shows. She also loved being in her backyard garden and was a big supporter of the QVC channel. Anne Beard Madison Wallace, age 94, of Mason City, died Sunday, October 16th at Crestview Care Center in West Branch, where she was a resident. A celebration of life will be held at a date to be decided. Interment will be in Springfield, South Dakota. Anne found opportunities to make a full life of activities, including PEO, Women's Society, Questers, Occidental Study Club, church committees, prayer chain, and other volunteer service organizations. Howard Richard Miller, age 90, of Iowa City, passed away peacefully in his sleep on November 24th at the Solon Nursing Care Center. Howard served in the U.S. Navy in the Pacific during the Korean conflict. Howard was a member of many organizations throughout his life, including the JCs, Kiwanis, and Rotary Club. He was the founding scoutmaster of Troop 560 in Cedar Rapids. He spent his career at NCR in Dayton and eventually moved to Cedar Rapids, where he worked at Rockwell Collins until he retired in 1995. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday, November 29th at Lensing's Oak Hill at 210 Holiday Road in Coralville. Dorothy A. Marsh, born Dorothy A. Dorman, age 98, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on Friday, November 25th, surrounded by her loving family. Visitation, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 29th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Funeral service, 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 29th at the funeral home. Dorothy retired from CRST. She was an avid roller skater as a teenager. She enjoyed her early years as PTA president of Taylor Elementary and Wilson Junior High Schools. She spent many hours sewing for her daughters and was an excellent seamstress. She volunteered by cooking and entertaining the Wednesday night youth group at the Asbury United Methodist Church, where she was a lifetime member. The neighborhood swim and card group gave her much enjoyment, and travel was one of her greatest thrills. From the sports page, Mike Loss writes, "What a great day for college basketball fans in Iowa. Cyclone men's and women's teams and Hawkeye women seek prestigious tourney titles. Sundays in November are reserved sports real estate for the NFL, but not today in Iowa. What a day this is for college basketball in our state, although all three of the games on the docket will be played in Portland, Oregon. It's not any old day in Iowa. It's not any old day Iowa plays the nation's most storied women's basketball program in the nation on network television, but that's what's up at noon. The number 9 Hawkeyes play number 4 Connecticut in the championship game of the Phil Knight Legacy Tournament. At 6:30, the 5th-ranked Iowa State women's team meets number 8 North Carolina in the title game of the Phil Knight Invitational on ESPN2. And at 9, unranked but dangerous Iowa State plays unbeaten and ranked Connecticut in the championship of the men's Phil Knight Invitational. The Iowa women played UConn in the 2021 Sweet 16, with the Huskies prevailing, as expected. Husky star Paige Buchers has a knee injury and is out for the season, so they naturally have kept winning. Ozzy Fudd, a sophomore guard, has gone from averaging 12 points last season to 26 this one. Billionaire Phil may have wanted number 1 North Carolina to win its way to that game, but Iowa State foiled that with a 70-65 win over the Tar Heels on Friday. Iowa's Caitlin Clark scared every Hawkeyes and women's basketball fan when she got hurt at Kansas State recently, but she missed no time to Oregon State's chagrin. Clark had 28 points, 9 rebounds, 8 assists, and 0 turnovers in the Hawkeyes' 73-59 win. Today it's ABC and it's showtime. UConn, still is UConn, with great shooting and great defense, unbeaten with an average winning margin of 29 points. The Hawkeyes were discussed as a Final Four contender before the season. This game will be a measuring stick. A win would be a big bridge crossed. Iowa State's women's team has been a dynamo so far this season. That was clearly evident Friday when the Cyclones routed Michigan State 80-49 in a tourney semifinal. The Spartans entered with a 6-0 record. They may have left wondering if they just played a national title threat. Iowa State held MSU to 28.3% shooting, while Cyclone post player Stephanie Soares made 10 of 14 shots, scored 23 points, and had 11 rebounds and 6 block shots. The addition of 6'6" Soares has made ISU a different level of good. It was already a premier team with a first-team preseason, All-American in Ashley Jones. Then you plug in Soares, a 2-time NAIA National Player of the Year. She has blended in with her new team quickly and beautifully. North Carolina won 25 games and reached the NCAA's Sweet 16 last season. This would be a great win for the Cyclones' resume if they can get it. The day's finale is the unbeaten Iowa State men trying to finish off a fabulous tournament performance with a championship. Before beating North Carolina on Friday, the Cyclones downed Villanova in overtime on Thursday. Guard Caleb Grill made 1 basket in 39 minutes against Villanova. The next day against the nation's number 1 team, he made 7 three-pointers and scored a career-high 31 points. These Cyclones have more scoring options than last year's Sweet 16 team, but they're still defending, allowing just 53.5 points and 35.1% shooting. The 20th-ranked 7-0 UConn men beat number 18 Alabama by 15 points in the semifinals. The Huskies have a lot of shooters and are very good at defending and rebounding. If Iowa State wins this game, well, what a weekend. The Cyclones may set a record for the highest all-time jump in the AP Top 25 from being unranked. If you've beaten Villanova, North Carolina, and Connecticut in succession and no one stopped you, hello, stratosphere. The Iowa State-Iowa women's and men's games are December 7th and 8th, respectively, in Iowa City. Could Carver-Hawkeye Arena be the college basketball hub of the universe two straight nights? But first, today in Portland. Who needs the NFL? And also from Sports, Decisions Loom for Padilla and Others by John Stepp of the Gazette. The schedule will be relatively light for Iowa football next week. A little bit more time off this week than we wanted, Coach Kirk Ferentz said. The program will give the guys some time to recover, relax a little bit, and recharge, Ferentz said, now that a Big Ten championship game berth is out of the picture. Between the transfer portal, extra COVID-19 years of eligibility, and bowl opt-ins or opt-outs, some Iowa football players will have a lot to reflect on the next month before Iowa's next game. Quarterback Alex Padilla is among the Hawkeyes who will have a decision to make about whether to stay or enter the transfer portal. I feel like this situation was really good for me to come back into a competition, Padilla said after Iowa's open spring practice. But Padilla did not get opportunities when starter Spencer Petras went 11 of 25 against an FCS school or 12 of 26 against an Iowa State team that has only one Big 12 win. Even when Iowa built a 27-point lead against Nevada or a 19-point lead against Northwestern, Ferentz did not give Padilla any in-game snaps in garbage time. His first opportunity came in the second half of the loss to number 2 Ohio State after Petras had two interceptions in the first half. His only other action came after Petras' injury in Friday's loss to Nebraska. Padilla said he is only reflecting on this loss, though, for now. I haven't had the chance to really think about any of that right now, Padilla said. I'll have the time to reflect in the next couple weeks, but we'll see what happens. Wide receiver could be another interesting position with the transfer portal. Four players left after the 2021 season, and now Purdue's Charlie Jones has been a case study of what a receiver can do in a pass-heavy systems. Seniors will need to decide whether to use their extra COVID-19 year of eligibility. Ferentz said this month that preliminary conversations about possibly using the extra year have not happened yet. Possible NFL prospects opting out of lower-tier bowl games have been increasingly common across the country, although not as much at Iowa. Running back Tyler Goodson was the only opt-out last year. Center Tyler Linderbaum played in the bowl game. He and Jest called it even asking about it a dumb question, and paid the price with an injury that lingered in the following months. Linebacker Jack Campbell removed any fans' concerns about whether he would opt out with a simple answer Friday after the 24-17 loss to the Huskers. No, Campbell said. Campbell made the case for why other players should make that same decision as well. Anytime you get the opportunity to throw the Tiger Hawk on the side of your head and wear that jersey, I feel like that's an opportunity that every kid should seize, Campbell said. But again, it's everyone's decision. They can do what they want. In the History Happenings column by Jessica Klein and Rob Klein, Jessica Klein is a leadership and character scholar at Wake Forest University, and her dad, Rob Klein, is not a scholar of any kind. They write this monthly column for the History Center. Mabel Chadban Wilson, Gazette's first female reporter, would hide behind judges' desks to cover stiff trials. It sounds like a scene straight out of Hollywood, but it happened at the courthouse in Marion in the early 1900s. A young female reporter named Mabel Chadban found herself surrounded by angry Linn County supervisors. It seems Chadban had written a story criticizing the conditions in the county jail. The county supervisors objected, although that word isn't quite strong enough. Next day, when she went back to cover the courthouse, they mobbed her, pouring out their vehemence over her story, Harriet Swain reported in a November 19, 1939 Gazette story about Chadban's career. She listened as long as she could, then it was time to go upstairs for the opening of court. She took a few running steps to the top, turned to the howling band of supervisors, and announced rather stately, "You may all go to hell." Chadban, born in Chicago in 1883, came to the Gazette in 1913 at age 30 after being the city editor at newspapers in Bloomington and Champaign, Illinois. As Swain wrote, from 1913 to 1917, she wasn't known as a news reporter. She was referred to as the woman reporter, the first on the Gazette. Wilson, who first wrote for the Gazette under the byline Mabel Chadban before marrying Gazette city editor Josh Wilson in 1916, told Swain she was never insulted while doing her job, but I was a curiosity, and I don't wonder running around in sweeping skirts. Being a woman definitely had an effect on how she could do her job. Swain reported that after Chadban charmed a particularly gruff judge, he hid her behind his desk when a trial came up that was all right for her to hear, but a little too stiff for others to know a woman was sitting in on. Chadban didn't only cover the courts, however. Swain noted her early efforts included stories of overnight visits in the Old City Jail, interviews with stage celebrities, cowgirls, and race car drivers, stunt stories seldom attempted by newspaper women. She also penned a column called Wayside Notes in which she shared all manner of tidbits. Take, for instance, the Wayside Notes of Tuesday, February 24, 1914. Between a paragraph about a Des Moines teacher who apparently poisoned sparrows and mice to demonstrate the dangers of cigarettes, and another about a town in Illinois that put tramps to work before giving them food, was a section titled The School Nurse. Keokuk has taken a step forward in that it has employed a school nurse, she wrote. Reports from cities who have hired such an officer show that the investment has always been a profitable one. If a school nurse can make a bright boy where before he was a dullard, that alone is worth the salary she receives. The nurse, who has quietly called a child before her for examination and found that the child suffering from adenoids and diseased tonsils and has had these defects corrected, is certainly a valuable asset to any community. By the correction of such defects, the child is no longer dull and listless, but is suddenly transformed into a good student. Many an epidemic of diphtheria, scarlet fever, and other contagious diseases has been nipped in the bud because of the watchfulness of the school nurse. The Gazette once did a story about newsroom romances, including Mabel and Josh Wilson's meeting and marriage. The couple, who had a daughter in 1918, moved around the country as Josh Wilson pursued his newspaper career and Mabel raised their daughter. He wrote a piece about the Gazette's history in 1933, recalling his wife's impact, saying she was still known as Bright Eyes by newspaper men and women from coast to coast. Josh Wilson died in 1937, and Mabel Wilson moved back to Cedar Rapids in 1939 to live with her sister. She died at age 90 in 1973 in Kansas City, Missouri, where her daughter lived. She and her husband are buried at Oak Hill Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. We would like to thank Bonnie Dodge, a volunteer at the History Center and the Genealogical Society of Linn County, who discovered materials about Mabel Chadban Wilson and shared them with us, and Tara Templeton at the History Center, who assisted with our research. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, November 27th, 2022. I've been your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. It's kind of rainy outside today. Maybe that'll change later. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.